Just for the record, today is the 28th of March, and it's Wednesday morning at the JCC. We're learning the Shivim Panim Scholars Curriculum of the Milton Program. We're doing the beginning of the book of Exodus. Today we're in chapter 2 of the book of Shmot, which is unit 2 in the curriculum book. We're going to read to begin with, and then of course we'll think. So we're going to read from the very beginning of chapter 2. I have it open myself here in the JPS translation. And this, of course, is exactly where we left off last time. There's no verses we're skipping. A certain man of the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. When she saw how beautiful he was, she hid him for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she got a wicker basket for him and caulked it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child into it and placed it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stationed himself at a distance to learn what would befall him. The daughter of Paro came down to bathe in the Nile while her maidens walked along the Nile. She spied the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw that it was a child, a boy crying. She took pity on it and said, "This must be a Hebrew child." Then his sister said to Paro's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a Hebrew nurse to suckle the child for you?" And Paro's daughter answered, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Paro's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will pay your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Paro's daughter, who made him her son. She named him Moshe, explaining, "I drew him out of the water." That is the background to today's unit. Today's unit begins with verse 11. Actually worked it very good that the scholar's curriculum tells us to begin with verse 11, because the first 10 verses I taught the previous trimesters here in Milton this year in the Parshat Shavua class. So that's the background. We know about the birth of Moshe. And then the verses we want to concentrate on are verses now 11 to 23.
In chapter 2?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, just picking up exactly where we just left off. Sometime after that, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his kinsfolk and witnessed their labors. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. He turned this way and that, and, seeing no one about, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, he found two Hebrews fighting, so that he said to the offender, "Why do you strike your fellow?" He retorted, "Who made you chief and ruler over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Moses was frightened and thought, "Then the matter is known." When Paro learned of the matter, he sought to kill Moshe, but Moshe fled from Paro. He arrived in the land of Midian and sat down beside a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. But shepherds came and drove them off. Moses rose to their defense and he watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why did you leave the man? Ask him in to break bread." Moses consented to stay with the man, and he gave Moshe his daughter Tzipporah as wife. She bore a son whom he named Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." That's the unit. We want to do, of course, is go back now to the beginning, which means chapter 2, verse 11, and read it verse by verse and phrase by phrase and see what it has to tell us. And we'll do it together with the sheets I prepared. So I'm going back now to chapter 2, verse 11. Sometime after that, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his kinsfolk and witnessed their labors. That's the first half of verse 11. Let's just deal with that. I want to give a little bit of Hebrew insight. So I guess everyone has an English-Hebrew Tanakh, or some of you don't. You don't, right?
I don't have it.
So you have in the workbook the full Hebrew of our unit, and that's going to be found on page
26,
you say? Okay, that's it. Good morning. Abani, you need a workbook, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
So, since you've all opened the workbook, although most of you can have the Hebrew in your Tanakhim, I'm going to read the first verse that we just read on page 26 in Hebrew. Vayehi bayamim hahem, and it was in those days, v'igdal Moshe, and grew Moshe, v'yitzei el achav, and he went forth to his brethren, v'yar b'sivlotam, literally, and he saw in their suffering. V'yar, and he saw ish mitzri, an Egyptian man. We're not going on to the second half of the verse. So with that Hebrew, now that we have the English also, let's just think about it. So one point that's important for us is the fact that in this half verse, the first half of verse 11, there appears a verb that appeared also at the end of the previous unit, that is to say, chapter 2, verse 10. What verb appears in both of these two verses? Chapter 2, verse 10, and chapter 2, verse 11.
Suffering.
I don't see suffering in chapter 2, verse 10.
Just making it up.
Well, look inside. Don't make it up. Right. I didn't ask a question that requires thought, just to look in the verses. Right. Which verb appears in both chapter 2, verse 10 and chapter 2, verse 11?
Went down, went out.
Oh, come on.
Witness? No.
Oh, come on. In English it appears in both, in Hebrew it appears in both, in French it'll appear in both, in Russian it'll appear in both.
Grown up?
Yeah, he grew up. So now let me ask the question, is it repeating itself? Does the verb mean the same type of growing up in both verses, or does it mean something different? It could be repeating itself.
No, the preposition in verse 11 is had grown up.
Uh-huh.
And in when the child grew up.
Okay, so it's different, one, you're saying. So what's the difference?
One is from baby to person, and the other one.
Maturity. The other one is
maturity.
Right? So we're really following different stages in the growth of Moshe. In chapter 2, verse 10, the impression we get is that he grew up in the sense that he was weaned. Yeah. Right? He no longer needed his nursemaid, who was also his mother. So there, growing up is a matter of becoming age 2, perhaps, 2.5. But in verse 11, when it says that Moses grew up, it's something very different. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not that he no longer needs his nursemaid, but rather what? So Fanny said maturity.
More independent.
He's independent, he's mature.
Well, what it also says is that he goes to, quote, his kinsfolk.
Uh-huh.
No. His kinsfolk are the Hebrews.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
So between the time that he's a baby and by the time he finally reaches some maturity, we have no idea.
No idea, right.
What happened to him in his head or what his allegiance is where or anything else. So he must have known the whole time that A, he was a Hebrew, because if he went to his kinsfolk, how else would he know?
Absolutely.
And there is a certain awakening up here.
And in the Hebrew, you said his brethren used, as you said, it's the same thing. And
right.
That he knew that it was his brethren.
Right. He knew. Yeah. And like Miriam, but Miriam said a certain awakening. Now Miriam said awakening, that indicates that before you're awake, you're asleep. Right.
Well, you just really don't know, or you're in denial, or you're not...
Really don't know.
You're not intellectually ready, emotionally involved.
Yeah.
Because or as a child, he did not realize what a position he would rise to, and once he rose to that position, he could then assert himself.
And arise that position, you mean, be more specific?
Being the advisor.
Being an Egyptian prince, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know that he was.
Well, he certainly was.
Don't get him mixed up with Joseph, right? He's not given any particular position here.
Okay.
But he's Pharaoh's son, right? He, or should I say, grandson, perhaps? He grows up in the Egyptian court, and when Miriam talks about awakening, I think that implies something I would agree with, that he probably didn't have too much of a Jewish education as a child. I mean, he grew up from the age of 3 to the age of whatever it is, 15 or 20, 25 perhaps. He grew up in Paris court, wearing Egyptian clothing, speaking the Egyptian language most probably, with an Egyptian education. Now, certainly from the verses, looks like he knew that he was of Hebrew stock. But clearly what we're talking about is an awakening. We're talking about an adolescent identity crisis. We're talking about him realizing, wait a second, it's not so simple that I'm just an Egyptian prince. I've heard that I have Jewish Hebrew blood, and he goes out to explore his identity, I would think. There's an awakening, a sense of, and there's probably an identity crisis. And we could say that's all included in the word here, that he grew up. That he was in a growing process, a process of self-discovery, of looking for himself, perhaps. And again, we don't know how old he is, but I would imagine he's between 15 and 20, perhaps a little bit older, perhaps a tiny bit younger. It's hard to know. And someone mentioned also his kinsfolk, right, there was Eileen mentioned his kinsfolk. He went out to his kinsfolk, so he has a sense, despite his Egyptian upbringing and identity and education, has a sense that he has kin out there, and those kin are slaves. And those kin speak a different language than him. And they dress differently than him. Right? And they look differently than him. And their daily life is very, very, very different. And I can imagine him frustrated and wavering and imagining, am I one of them? No, am I not one of them? No, they probably looked very, very...
downtrodden.
What was the word?
Downtrodden.
Down, right, and so lower class compared to his aristocratic bearing and education. There's probably a real dissonance here, and he's trying to decide who he is. Perhaps. And I just want to point out, to add what Eileen said, the verse could have said he went out to the Israelites, but it didn't. It said he went out to his kinsfolk, and that's clearly purposeful. Right. Absolutely.
Implying that he knows it's his...
Right. He knows and he feels. He knows and he feels.
Right. That's the connection.
I didn't hear.
No, in the class with Brausev, last week,
yeah,
that we connect one with other Jewish people. So
I see. He felt something, okay? Right? We really wonder where his feeling came from, because he hasn't seen probably his parents for 15, 16 years.
But I mean, if he was nursed by his own mother, she must probably got a couple of...
Don't forget.
Right. Until the age of two, right? Until the age of two or three.
Plus the princess, Pharaoh's daughter knew he was a... She said, and she takes him out of the... She gets him from the water, and she says, this must be a child. So maybe she said something to him, you would guess.
That's fascinating, right? That's a fascinating point.
If everybody knew, somebody must have dropped him.
You wonder if Pharaoh's daughter gave him some type of Jewish education.
Maybe.
He at least told him.
Right.
You know, I would think.
He knew.
Well, especially if we go back to the lesson that you taught out right. of the wind. Somehow.
Right. Yeah.
Pharaoh's daughter actually went down to the Nile as, right. as though yeah. going to the mikveh.
Right, right. If she had some type of proto-philo identity, that she was like one of those evangelical Christians that admires the Jews, and she has this Jewish baby who she's taking care of, she perhaps instilled in him certain sense of Hebrew roots. You never know. We don't know, of course. So now going back to the Hebrew, the last phrase in the first half of this phrase is v'yar b'sivlotam.
Which line?
It's the first line, line 11, Yud Aleph. And I'll read the Hebrew again. V'hi b'yamim ahem, and it was in those days, v'igdal Moshe, and Moshe grew, v'itzei elachav, and he went out to his brethren, v'yar b'sivlotam. Literally, and he saw in their suffering. It doesn't just say v'yar et sivlotam, he saw their suffering. It says he saw in their suffering. If you want, he saw into their suffering. And there is an inference here. Well, you tell me. What does it mean? He saw in their suffering.
He's at least empathetic. I mean, he feels it.
Right. Absolutely. There's a degree of empathy here, of looking deeply and feeling and experience something. He saw, experienced their suffering, perhaps I would translate it. And the way we have it in our English translation, without unduly criticizing the JPS, and witnessed their labors, it doesn't carry the same connotation as the Hebrew does. He saw in their suffering. And I would just say one more thing before we go on, that perhaps that says something about the personality of Moshe, is a person who, when he looks, he sees. And when he sees, he feels. And he feels, he experiences. He's a man of empathy, like Miriam said. Next verse?
Do you think you could also add that he said he could almost put himself in their place?
That's what empathy is.
Yeah,
could be.
I mean, in the totality of him, of him seeing, I sit on a silken cushion and have somebody fan me when it's warm.
And they put me in the movies and make a movie about me. Ten Commandments.
And here he is. Here he's finally.
Yeah, but Bruce said, building on what Miriam said, I'm just thinking. Now, think of Moshe saying to himself, I could have been one of those slaves.
Could have been me.
Could have been me. Yeah. That's powerful, and that's disconcerting. Okay, the second half of the same verse in the English says, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. There's something superfluous there. From a grammatical, syntactical point of view, there's something superfluous. You could have left a few words out.
Says Hebrew and also says kinsman.
Yeah, it's one or the other. Say Hebrew or say kinsman. Why need both? But clearly,
make sure.
Right, from a psychological point of view, he saw a Hebrew and he felt it to be one of his kinsmen. That word kinsman, which is brother in the Hebrew, appears twice in one verse. Right. So we're being. It's having. It's. I'm sorry. The. Text is emphasizing for us that he has that sense of kinship with these people.
And he couldn't really have been his brother, his real brother.
Oh, right, of course. it could have been, but we don't assume that it was, right? It means kinsman.
Anything.
It doesn't say his brother, it says his brethren in the right. plural.
But this is a good brethren, you know. We are brothers in crime is one way to look at it. He's not a brother in crime. He is we have the same. We're coming out of the same genetic pool in today's parlance.
Yeah, they're kinsmen. I think that's a good translation. So then we go on. He turned this way and that, and seeing no one about, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. I also want to look at the Hebrew in that verse. There's one particular phrase, again, that the English doesn't fully get. And here we are. So it's Yud Bet in the Hebrew, 12. V'yifen ko v'cho. And he turned there and there. V'yar. And he saw. That's the third time the verb see appears in these verses. And what did he see? Ki ein ish. He saw that there was no ish.
No man.
V'yach et the Mitzri. And he struck the Mitzri. V'yitmanehu b'chol. And he hit him in the sand. And the phrase that's going to be very important for us is in the middle of the verse that we just read. Ki ein ish. He saw there was no man. So there's no man. So, have anything to say about that? He saw there was no man?
Sounds like there's nobody there.
Clearly, Caroline's right. On the simple level, he saw that the coast is clear, right? That he can do what he has to do and he won't get caught.
No Egyptian.
Nobody who had any power.
There was no Egyptian, but there might have been Hebrews.
They didn't exist as far as he was concerned. It didn't matter if they were there.
Okay, that could be, right? It could be. Fine. Let me remind everyone of a statement that appears in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. I put it actually on the sheet for us. Where did I put it? I put it in 3D. B'makom she'ein ish, hishtadeh liyot ish. Where there's no man, make every effort to be a man.
Wow.
What does the word man mean there?
Nobody to stand up for this person
to
do what's right.
There could have been lots of men in the room, but where there's no man, and I don't mean man as opposed to woman, I mean man as opposed to wimp, right?
Yes,
basically.
No one of authority.
No one of stature. No one of moral stature, perhaps. A mensch. And in this context, we could see the verse from Isaiah that I quoted there. So hold your fingers in Exodus, where we are, and go to Isaiah 59:15, which might actually be a commentary on our verse in Exodus. So we hold our fingers where we are, and we go to Isaiah, the book of Yeshayahu. By the way, Rabbi Zeph's Hebrew name is Yeshayahu. So we're going to the book of Rabbi Zeph, 59:15. Page 745 in the JPS English only. 15 and 16.
What again was that?
Isaiah 59:15. And here the prophet is speaking for God, and he says as follows: honesty has been lacking, he who turns away from evil is despoiled. The Lord saw and was displeased that there was no redress. He saw that there was no ish. He gazed long, but no one intervened. Then his own arm won him triumph. In other words, God saw there was no ish, so God had to be the ish. And no ish means there was no redress. And that, again, could be a commentary on our verses in Exodus. That Moshe saw there was no ish. So now I want to kind of focus a little more. Moshe saw there's no ish. Could we explain that or understand it as Moshe looking at the Egyptians and seeing no ish? Can we explain it as Moshe looking at the Hebrews and seeing no ish?
Could be either one. Could
right.
be both.
Mm-hmm. I have a comment here from when we talked about it earlier in some other time, and it said he's a person now without an identity. He doesn't know, or nobody knows if he's here or there.
I actually think that that's 100% on target, but another three verses. I would think that at this point his identity is unraveling, but it hasn't unraveled completely. Or is in the, you're right, it's just about to unravel, right? It's just about to unravel. Yeah, that's certainly what's happening. So if you're Moshe, and you know yourself at least on one level as an Egyptian, and you see this terrible injustice that you really weren't aware was going on for the first 15, 20 years of your life, and here is this Egyptian beating mercilessly a slave, and there's many, many other Egyptians around, but you look and there's no ish. There's no one to say stop that. There's no one to say that's not fair. It doesn't make sense. You can imagine in some sense a German in World War II looking at a SS guard beating a Jew and looking around and saying, there's lots of Germans, but there's no ish. There's no one to say that can't be. And just as well, on the other hand, you can say that there's many Hebrews around. And Moshe says there's no ish. In other words, there's no one there to stand up for the other. They're all slaves with their heads in the ground, heads in the sand, not really looking at what's happening, not caring, or being so despondent and frustrated and so disenfranchised that they can't do anything. And he's an ish.
So actually, he may not be thinking about himself either way, whether an Egyptian, or he just has two people fighting. It could have been just two people and somebody hurting somebody else and felt that he should come to the aid of the person who's being hurt.
That, I think that you're right on one level, but on the other level, it was emphasized in verse 11 that he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. So it's probably both. It's probably both a human matter of just one human being lording it over another. But on the other level, it is a matter of someone hitting a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. I don't know if Moshe himself can sort out what's going on in his soul, the different levels of motivation there.
Well, he must have been able to tell them apart.
Of course, to tell them apart. Well, yeah.
So, I mean, when he refers to kinsmen, I think there's a real emphasis that this is going on between people that are close to him, at least in his head and in his heart, and the Egyptian. So, I'm not so sure whether he would have done that if it hadn't been his kinsmen.
You're saying that's a question, if it would have done it?
To me, that's a question.
Yeah, I think it, you could certainly... can certainly say that.
The thing against that, Rabbi, is that later on it says that, you know, he's so surprised that somebody knew, or I mean, that they were talking about it. I mean, but if there were all kinds of people around who were just ignoring this injustice, he
right.
would have known that.
Right. I didn't... Right. I think I overemphasized my point. I didn't mean that there were people there and still saw no ish. I think you have to say the pshat is that there was no one there. But in addition, on a deeper level, he felt that there was no ish.
Yeah.
There was even if there were people there, they wouldn't have intervened.
To do any justice but himself.
Yeah. Yeah. So just one more thing in this verse. How do you evaluate Moses' behavior? You give him good marks or bad marks?
It's kind of impetuous for what he's doing. Of course, I mean, I'm not living in this time, and I'm not him. But I'm thinking, if you have that much power, and you see that an Egyptian hits or hurts someone else, you might want to go ahead and do something about it and change the conditions that brings about this kind of behavior, rather than kill someone. So I was looking around saying, oh, either they don't see it, or they're going to cover up for me. They're not going to give me away, you know, the Hebrews, or just sort of fly off the handle and kill somebody. I think says something about his character.
And what does it say about his character?
That he's not deliberate.
Deliberative.
He's not deliberative.
But he's not thinking. I think it's characteristic of someone that age, maybe, that's in position.
That's what I'm saying.
Once he sees something, it becomes wrong. Like he's just going to take charge and do it, and take care of it himself, right then and there. Not like an older person that might say, "Well, we'll have a meeting and we'll decide what to do about this," you know.
But can we also read into this that he would not have done this if he saw one Egyptian beating up another Egyptian?
Okay, that comes to what Miriam said and to what Eileen said, the little bit of tension between their two opinions. And that's why we have further stories, right? Right. The first one is between Jew and non-Jew. The second is between two Jews. And the third is between two non-Jews. And he gets involved in all three
levels.
Cases. Right. So anyway, I just want to summarize what was just said. So Moshe has a deep, deep sense of compassion and empathy and justice. On the other hand, we might say that he is a little bit too impetuous, right? And not deliberative enough. Although you could say there was nothing else he could do but strike out. There was no court that we could go to and say this Egyptian taskmaster is too mean. He would have been laughed at in the face, right? Perhaps. So it's hard to know. I have on my sheet just one more interesting question in 3E. How do you think that Moshe felt after he did what he did? Just think about that. I'm not sure there's no right answer, of course.
Maybe he felt justified that he did what he did. He felt good about it. It finally confirmed something about his identity that he stood up for.
That's a good point. Not only did he actually manage to bring about justice, but he also managed to decide who he was and prove himself that he's...
He had to know what was coming down once it was found out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's when he fled.
Yeah, he ran because he knew what was going to happen.
After one more incident, right, when he knows that he's become known. And certainly when he killed the Egyptian, he didn't fully think out what would happen, I assume. Yeah, right. He didn't deliberate about it.
Well, and plus, since he was such a hierarchy in the Egyptian world, if you will, he probably didn't think about his consequences either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm, you know, just he didn't think it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Once he made his place.
He made his statement, whether he meant it or not.
Then
claimed
his identity.
Mm-hmm. So the maturing process accelerated. Mm-hmm. Yes, big time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. By the way, I probably all told everyone in this class, do you remember my story about my Hebrew name?
Which is?
Hanan. So I'll tell you the story. It's just what someone just said, that in a moment here, he fixed his identity. So when I was in high school, I was brought up in a completely secular framework without any really real Jewish education. And as a teenager in high school, I joined Young Judea, a Zionist youth movement. In the summer between 10th and 11th grade, I went to Israel for a six-week program. And we were 23 16-year-olds on the plane going to Israel, and we hardly knew each other's names, got to know each other on the plane. And I said to myself, this is a good time to take a Hebrew name. I didn't remember, I didn't have it in my consciousness. My parents gave me a Hebrew name at my bar mitzvah. That was not part of my sense of who I was. So I said to myself, the first Israeli soldier we meet, upon getting off the plane, I'll ask him his name, whatever his name is, I'll take it. And his name was Hanan. So the whole story, so I asked him his name, Hanan, so I took the name Hanan. So then I get, after a wonderful summer, get back to high school, and in my last 2 years of high school, I use the name Hanan in my Young Judea movement, and I use my regular name in high school with my parents and everything. So now fast forward, after high school, I went for a year to Israel, and the whole year I was called Hanan. I told her, that's my name, fine. So then, after a year in Israel, I get back from Israel in August and I begin university. And the first day that I was at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, I walk into the student commons to get my mailbox, key to the mailbox, and someone, another student, just said, came up to me and said, "Hi, you know, you're a freshman, nice to meet you, what's your name?" And I had no idea what to tell him. No idea. Because after, for a whole year I'd been called Hanan, but I realized in that moment, if I tell him Hanan, it'll be hard to pronounce. He'll stumble over it, and I will have marked myself as a Jew on campus. And if I give my other name that my parents use and I always use in high school, I'll be a free man. I'll be able to not necessarily be part of the Jewish community. And I didn't know. I stood there frozen. No idea what my name was. But after what seemed like an eternity, which probably was a split second, when I said Hanan, I realized that I sealed my identity in a moment. And I'm here today, right? Because of that split-second decision.
You legally changed your...
Later in Israel, I changed it, yeah. And I changed it in America also. I was waiting for that question. Should I tell you?
Yes.
I was born Scotch Schlesinger.
Scott.
And I haven't heard that name
for your
decades.
So your family changed, started calling you Hanan as well?
My father did. My mother had issues, and whatever she calls me, it's fine. She kind of refrains from using any name.
Hey, you.
Does the name Hanan mean anything in particular? Does it have a particular meaning?
It means to deal gracefully.
To do what?
Deal gracefully.
Oh, that's
like
nice.
God is called Hanun, yeah. Which means gracious. Gracious.
That worked out nicely.
Very
I
nice.
Hope so.
I'm sure glad that soldier had that name.
Yeah, what if his name had been Yerachmiel? Okay, so anyway, so Moses seals his identity, so it seems really, like you guys said, in one fell swoop. Verse 13. When he went out the next day, he found two Hebrews fighting. So he said to the offender, "Why do you strike your fellow?" So I, on the sheet, asked one question, which we really already talked about. It's now two Hebrews, as opposed to a Hebrew and an Egyptian. And he gets involved in any case. And if he gets involved in any case, then we realize that his empathy is not only for Hebrews when they're attacked from the outside, when they're attacked by foreigners, by Egyptians. Even within the Jewish people, he has a sense of justice and injustice, and he wants to do the right thing. He retorted in verse 14, "Who made you chief and ruler over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Moses was frightened and thought, "Then the matter is known." So, what would you say about the Hebrew that said these words to Moshe?
He didn't know whether or not Moshe was going to be Pharaoh too.
What do you mean by that?
Well, that he was going to be just like Pharaoh. They didn't know that Moses was going to be a kind, graceful, good leader.
Yeah, but you know,
or
they
who
talk
are you to
who
tell
you
us
to, you know, basically.
But you know, they treat him like an equal. They say to him, "Look, you're one of us. What made you, who's one of us and who killed somebody, what makes you the judge of us?"
I read it differently.
Well, you can read it any which way. But how come you are going to be so high and mighty to say that we do the wrong thing when you've done something wrong?
Yeah.
Now, I cannot imagine if the Hebrews knew, thought that he was Egyptian, I cannot imagine them having this kind of lip to him and giving him this kind of talk. Mm. They wouldn't have told him that.
I kind of read it just the opposite, although perhaps the difference between us is not that great.
Do you really think that they would have said that to Pharaoh?
No, they would have said it. Wouldn't said it to Pharaoh, but what I would say...
This is Pharaoh's son.
But I think that there is an element of rejection here. We don't want you. Who brought you into our affairs? Stay out of our affairs. We can take care of ourselves.
Our community takes care of itself.
Which means that they're saying, you're not really one of us.
Yeah, but I mean, what I'm saying, it also could mean that you are one of us. And why do you get involved? Because maybe they knew that he was Hebrew. Maybe the whole world knew that he was Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So where do you come from to tell us if you're one of us? You have nothing to say to us.
Because you're one of us.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm reading it just the opposite, but I hear what you're saying.
In the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. I was very much involved in. I went to many, many cities where there was a young African American who was telling the people living in the community, you've got to get together, you've got to band together, you've got to revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what the answer was from many of them? Leave us alone. Mm-hmm. We know how bad it is. We can live with it. We don't want it to get any worse.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what they think.
I really have my question about how they have the chutzpah to tell him that if they thought he was Egyptian and he was a prince.
Mm-hmm. Well, just like in Bruce's example, which I'm really resonates with me, there, even though the guy who came, you said, is black, but he's being rejected, right? You're an outsider. You don't really understand what's going on in our lives.
It's true.
And I would say that theoretical black guy you're thinking of there has a sense of, I came to help and I'm being rejected. They don't want me. They,
I took my life and I had to come here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, especially the white guy who was standing there too.
And probably the guy that you're describing came in a tie.
Me.
And the people in the seats.
They didn't come with a tie.
Yeah.
No, you bought overalls.
Mm-hmm.
So would you think, why am I here? Or what do I need to be involved? Or do they need me? Do they want me?
They sure did.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, on one hand, just like what we're reading, they didn't like the condition that they were in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they were afraid to take a step to get them out of this mm-hmm. predicament. But they were saying it could be a lot worse if he made us work more hours. Mm-hmm. If Pharaoh made us work more hours a day, mm-hmm. cut our rations.
Yeah, but I think Eileen asked you, but how did you feel? But you were there, right?
I was too dumb to know what danger I was.
They were only good to go to court. You know, they only.
I mean, did you feel like you were wasting your time?
Yeah.
That you had rejected you.
Would they come back with a statement like that? You still felt like you were there.
No,
for a purpose?
No, we were intelligent enough to understand the psychology.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That we were dealing with, the mindset. Because there were always a few leaders who would step up and say, let's risk it. Mm-hmm. We ain't got nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. We have nothing now.
Wow, that really is very relevant to to this. Okay, so reading on. Moshe was frightened and thought then the matter is known. And of course, if we go back to some of the things you guys said earlier, that perhaps when Moshe saw there was no Ish, it means there was no Egyptian, but there were Hebrews there. And Moshe relied on the fact that the Hebrews wouldn't give him away. But now it turns out that the Hebrews had given him away. So I would think that he feels stabbed in the back. The very people that he's come to identify with now reject him, which in my mind brings us to what Eileen said a few minutes ago. He's now a man without an identity.
Yeah, but
right?
You know, there's also this question. The Egyptian that he killed is dead. And the Pharaoh says, how did this happen? How did this Egyptian get killed? Now, he kind of asked around.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so sure he asked around nicely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, and so somebody found, he said, well, it wasn't us. You know what? It was your own don't
right.
die.
Right.
Okay.
Right, right, right.
So I'm not so sure whether the question was they gave him away. It was a question of who done did it. I mean, there was an inquiry.
Okay, so you're saying that even if it's they that gave him away, we can't blame them because they were tortured.
Not only that, I mean, the whole thing was probably was research. How did this happen? Who was there? Who witnessed it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I am sure that might have been difficult not to say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was your own son, your own adopted son.
Mm-hmm. I can identify with that. You know, think of the Holocaust again.
Yeah.
They have ways of finding out. But still, Moshe will feel that he's been stabbed in the back by the very people that he came to identify with. And he ends up being a former Egyptian who wanted to become a Hebrew. The Egyptians no longer want him. There's a price on his head. The Hebrews don't want him. They've stabbed him in the back. And he ends up being a fugitive. Right? Moses fled from Paro. He arrived in the land of Midian and sat down beside a well. So within a few days, perhaps even within a few hours, he's been gone from being an aristocrat who perhaps is high up in the Egyptian hierarchy. He's received the best education. He's been groomed to be who knows what. And within a few hours or days, he becomes nothing. No food, no family,
no water,
no future. And who knows how many days or weeks or months or years he wandered around from place to place and from tribe to tribe and from oasis to oasis until he finally got to Midian. And what happens in the next verse happened. Right. Okay, so here we go. Verse 16. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. But shepherds came and drove them off. Okay, so I guess the shepherds were male, and the shepherds wanted to water their flocks first and didn't let these women water their own flocks. Moses rose to their defense and he watered their flock. So that's Moshe again. It's the same man, right?
Move over.
Right.
That's a good person.
Right.
He even thought women were equal.
Not only women.
He watered their flock.
Yeah.
He did the work.
That's right.
Yeah. And they were Midianites. There's no Jews involved, right? It's not an Egyptian against the Hebrew, and it's not 2 Hebrews. They're complete strangers. He has nothing at stake here, no identity. He just sees injustice, and he rises up and kills all the shepherds.
I didn't kill them. I don't think.
Why did I say that? Right, because he could have done what he did in Egypt.
Yeah.
He didn't.
He learned from that.
It could be he's matured. Mm-hmm. Right. If you take the view that in Egypt he acted a bit impetuously and a bit immaturely, a bit flying off the handle, like Miriam said, then you might say he's learned his lesson and he's matured.
It was also outnumbered.
He's outnumbered.
You've got to think a little bit about that.
Which means that you might say it's not a change in maturity level, it's simply a change in circumstances.
Yeah.
Right, so there's 2 ways of looking at it,
I think. There was an issue there. I mean, the shepherds were serious. They had most probably a staff and all of that. And, you know what I'm saying? They could have clobbered him.
But Miriam, you're implying if there had only been 1 shepherd, he would have killed him.
I don't think so. It might have pushed him in the well. We don't know.
But we don't know.
He's gotten a little better.
Oh, okay. So you're willing to concede that
the maturity has set in.
But of course, we could also say that what he did in Egypt in killing Egyptian was not a matter of lack of maturity. It was just the only course available to him to make his point.
Well,
to do what had to be done. There's nothing else he could have done. There was no recourse he could have had to Egyptian courts, and the Hebrews wouldn't do anything. The only thing he could do is to strike the Egyptian. If the Egyptian died, well,
He died.
But now I hear here in verse 16, he is protecting the daughter of the priest of Midian.
But he doesn't know that. He doesn't know that.
Seven daughters.
No. The shepherd, the other shepherds knew that.
Uh-huh.
The guys who he pushed, the guys who he intervened against knew that, I assume they all knew that these young ladies were the daughters of the priest of Midian, who was probably a high muggly muck.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been afraid of the priest of Midian.
But they were oppressing the daughters of the priest.
That's right, yeah. So, but that's why they didn't go and try to take them out, you know.
Okay. Now, I just thought of something that I could have said 3 minutes ago. I addressed this primarily to the two lawyers in the group.
Mm-hmm.
Let's.
Three.
Oh, so three, really?
I'm another one.
Okay, so let's say that the year is in the 1850s, 1840s. Or let's say the year is the 1950s in the South, Texas. Mm-hmm. And a case comes before you, as a judge or a lawyer. A case comes before you. This white guy. No. No, his complexion is not clear.
What we call a seventh water in New
Orleans. Uh-huh.
It's a mixture of people from the South.
His complexion is not clear. He killed a white person, and his defense is that that white person was whipping, oppressing, humiliating a black. That's the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the case. What's going to happen? No matter what his complexion is.
That's right. At least then.
Mm-hmm. To make it more ambiguous, how more recent do I have to go? Is it 1950?
Yeah,
to go to 1970.
Even if he were tried by a jury, I mean, nobody ever convicted anybody. If it was a black person, mm-hmm. nobody ever let him go. Mm-hmm. If it's a white person, certainly was convicted.
Was convicted?
Yeah.
Even though he acted in order to prevent injustice. It was not. It was manslaughter or unpremeditated murder.
Not until the feds step in, nothing happens.
Okay.
Years after years, nothing happens to murderers, and the federal government takes it up years after as a civil rights violation because they can't retry him for murder or whatever it is. And if somebody defends somebody, he goes right along with them.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm confused as to what you're saying.
What you're saying is if a white person defended a black person and murdered somebody, right?
Defended him when he was being humiliated and whipped.
Or defended him in court?
No. Defended him on the street.
On the street.
By killing the
offender.
Offender. If his goose would be cooked.
Say it again?
His goose would be cooked. I mean, he would not get any justice. He would be...
Who
is defending whom? I mean, give me the scenario.
The scenario is a man whose complexion I didn't notice.
Okay.
He's Moshe.
Okay.
He sees a white person spitting on, stamping on the back of a black person in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And the man of unknown complexion, in a moment of indignation, gets up and kills the offender. That was the case I presented. That's our case right here.
His defense would be, I saw this injustice and therefore I stepped in. And you say it's in the deep south. And this man of unknown complexion is going to be tried in a court of law for murder. He's gone.
Yes.
He doesn't get justice. He can't use that as a defense. But there is actually in the law a statute that says in defense of others.
Mm-hmm.
If you commit murder in defense of others, that mm-hmm. is a mitigating mm-hmm. circumstance, mm-hmm. just like manslaughter, you know, mm-hmm. temper, or whatever.
Okay, so that's our case.
It wouldn't have worked.
It would mm-hmm. not have worked.
It would not have worked for the guy in court.
Okay. So Moshe, in place of becoming leader of the Jewish people, would be in jail or lynched.
Maybe.
In the Talmud, that would work if you had two witnesses.
Two witnesses to what?
To the person that defended to kill somebody in defense of another person. You can kill somebody in defense of another person.
But the question would be, of course, was the white guy, the taskmaster, was he about to kill the Hebrew? Or was he only humiliating him?
Or was he only punishing him, whatever you call it.
Right. There are so many different factors here, but of course the reason I'm getting all into all this is, how do we evaluate the character of Moshe?
Complicated guy.
But I would say, this is my opinion now, the reason that the text brings these three stories of Moshe intervening to save the Hebrew from the Egyptian, Moshe intervening to save the Hebrew from the Hebrew, and Moshe intervening to save the non-Hebrew from the non-Hebrew, it brings these three stories in this order clearly to tell us about the greatness of Moshe and why he was chosen to be the leader of the Jewish people. This is a man with a tremendous moral sense, a tremendous sense of justice, tremendous empathy, right? And he's willing not to sit on the sidelines. He's willing to enter into the fray and do something for the cause of justice. That's clearly the reasons that he was selected. Now, it could be that certain commentators or certain people in this room or even all of us have qualms perhaps with the way he acted in killing an Egyptian. But I think that the purpose of the text is not for the reader to bring up any moral qualms, but rather the reader is supposed to identify with this great man who has such a sense of justice, such a willingness to risk everything to serve the cause of justice. That's what it looks like to me.
Well, it's also sort of showing his ability of leadership because he acts.
He acts.
Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't want to say that Moses, you know, was wrong or this or that or the other, but I'm seeing that there are many sides to him.
Yeah, right. So let's just finish off the story and then go to some of the commentators. Let me just think. How long do we have? We have until 10:30, right? So we read the following. Verse 18. When they returned to the father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds." Notice they call him an Egyptian because his garb and his language and his mannerisms, they're all Egyptian. Mm-hmm. "He even drew water for us and watered the flock." And someone already pointed out, he did not only defend them from the shepherd, but he also watered the flock. "He said to his daughters, 'Where is he then? Why did you leave the man? Ask him to break bread with us.' Moses consented to stay with the man, and he gave Moshe's daughter Tzipporah as wife." And of course, living so many years in Midian and taking Tzipporah's wife really means that he's developing a third identity. He lived as a child as an Egyptian. He then developed an identity of empathy and connection with his kinsmen, with his Hebrews. And now he seems to have lost both those identities, and he's willing to become someone else. And a former Egyptian aristocrat becomes now a Midianite shepherd. "She bore a son whom he named Gershom." And Gershom means literally Gershom, a stranger or a sojourner there. "For," he said, I've been a stranger sojourner in a foreign land." Sham, there. Now I want to ask you a very, very difficult question. What exactly is the meaning of the name he gives his first son? What is indicated by this name? Sojourner, stranger, there.
It's him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Where is there? Where is there? It could be where he came from, or it could be where he is now. And it could be both. And can you imagine? Well, all three possibilities. So Moshe says, "I was a stranger in a strange land," and by that he would mean Egypt, "and now I found my home." That's one possibility. Another possibility is the opposite. He's saying that I used to be at home, but now I'm a stranger in a strange land. It's another possibility. A third possibility, he says, I'm always a stranger. I was a stranger there, I'm a stranger there, and I'm never at home anywhere.
I think that's what it is.
That makes sense. Sounds very plausible.
Yes.
Because, you know, as a person who has moved beyond a lot in her life, you never really belong anywhere. You can live someplace for 50 years, and, you know, you're a foreigner. You came from Europe, and then you live there, and then you come to Dallas, and everybody's very nice. But you need to hear, you know, that you're not from Dallas. It's strange.
Yep.
And I have a friend who said, you know, I don't know anymore where I belong. He now lives in Birmingham. He said, I don't know anymore where I belong. I mean, I'm not from Orleans, I'm not here, I'm not from New York anymore. My head is totally messed up about where I belong. The thing is, you got to participate in the community and do all that. You still don't belong. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
And I cannot even imagine him. I mean, you know, it's even more so.
But is that the way you or somebody feels, or is that the perception you have, or is that how you're feeling? I mean, other people can have...
Well, other people can feel what you feel.
No,
I'm an immigrant, so, I mean, I'm forever at the wrong place.
Nobody may think of you as that baby. That is...
Their perception. I'm talking about my perception.
Right, your perception.
And sometimes it's reinforced and sometimes it isn't. And sometimes you feel you really belong and sometimes you don't. But it is never complete. I mean, you know, I have said to many people, I'm always an outsider. You know, and they say, why do you say that? That's just the way I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I kind of can identify with him. It's got to be even more so for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, imagine you were a prince in a palace, I guess, of unbelievable splendor and richness. Mm-hmm. And here you wind up, what is he no longer more than a shepherd?
And that's the torn identity that makes him fitting to be, paradoxically, a leader. Right? Perhaps we're being told that an ideal leader, in a certain sense, has to be an outsider. He can't be just one of the boys. And he has to be a man of torn identity. He has to be beyond the fray, above the fray, in addition to what we learned about his empathy and his sense of justice and morality. But he also has to be, to a certain degree, different, a foreigner. Especially when you come to lead slaves, you can't have a slave mentality. Right? You have to be above.
You have to have a vision.
You have to have a vision. Right? You have to be above slavery. And just think of it. You come to lead slaves when you've never been a slave. But it perhaps can't be otherwise, because a slave can't ever lead slaves.
Yeah. You're sort of complacent when you've always been in the same place and have all the things that someone who's had to move around doesn't have, but still.
We've had slave revolts in the
United States. Okay, right.
Which is responsible for Louisiana.
All generalities have their exceptions, certainly. Just let me say one more thing on the subject, which just came to me. We, in the 21st century, think about Moshe as Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher, our leader, and we accept him as one of our own. But back in his time, he was an outsider to the Israelites that he came to lead. Just think about that. Right? And he was always being challenged his whole life. Remember all the complaints and everything. Part of it is, he's not one of us.
Okay. Well, we've never done it that way. That's what I hear. We've never done it that way.
Right.
You know, that seems to be a very important part of how the civilized Western world has developed, by people who don't accept the mediocrity and people who speak out against what is going on an everyday basis. It happens in the Bible. We're seeing it here in our Tanakh. We should, and if you want to be open-minded about it, it's really happening in the world that we all live in.
Explain.
Thank you. when you buck the trend, you gain enemies, and you then engage in a conversion of your enemies by showing your enemies that they are actually destructive of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a very hard thing to make people understand. We all like the old time. We don't want to see
time.
We don't want to see any change. We're afraid to step forward.
Right.
That
right.
can be from the way schools refuse to deliver education to children because it ain't the way my grandpa did it.
Change is always scary.
Mm-hmm. Change is scary. And, and when people sort of speak out and move for change, they're ostracized.
Okay, and indeed, Moshe encounters again and again and again them reminiscing about the good old days when we ate watermelon and leeks in Egypt.
It's good meat in the pans, all the scouts.
Sira basar, how do you say in English, the flesh pots of Egypt.
Flesh pots, exactly. That's what I'm referring.
Yeah.
Maybe there wasn't flesh pots.
There probably wasn't, but it was the good old days, like you said.
It seems like it. Yeah.
Okay, so one more thing before we go to the commentators, and I know that time is late, but I think it's really most important just to see the verses on our own. The commentators, I think, in a certain sense, are secondary. The one more thing is, let's just see now the three stories of Moshe that we learned today in the context of what we've seen earlier in the book of Genesis, what we know from the book of Genesis. In the book of Genesis, we know Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and the Torah told us quite a bit about them. Have any of, not only Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, but Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, and all those Jewish leaders, which of them have had, concerning them, described similar experiences to what Moshe had?
Abraham moved around a lot.
Wait a minute. Abraham was told to go. That's number one. And
but he was also a wanderer who had to adapt a new identity.
Exactly.
Right?
And he got a new identity because all the servants called Abraham,
as did his wife.
Sarah also, right, had to leave behind family.
Right.
An identity, a new identity. Mm-hmm. As far as Abraham, I'm also thinking of him sitting in his tent and accepting guests. Not exactly the same things we have here, but he's willing to, he wants to help, he has empathy for others he doesn't know. Mm-hmm. Right? He accepts
the
three
guests. Hospitable person.
Hospitality.
That we aspire to be.
Mm-hmm. Like. So what about Yitzhak and Rivka? Anything there that reminds us of what Moshe has gone through? Oh, come on. How did they meet?
At the well.
At the well. Who did what at the well?
Right. It's Rachel.
Rebecca. She watered all the...
Rebecca watered all the his camels, right?
Yeah.
Just like Moshe watered the camels. Here, so she shows some of those characteristics that Moshe later showed, of just complete empathy and help for a stranger.
And for animals.
And for animals, okay, for animals, that's very good, right. And you know, here was flocks, there was camels, right. And then we come to Jacob. What about Jacob?
He had to flee his home.
Had to flee, right. Again, he has to become a foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
Fugitive. I also didn't mention that the same thing with Rebecca. She has to leave her family to come to his family, right? So, but Jacob has to become a fugitive. And think of, again, Jacob and Wells. A well. Right, Jacob married Rachel.
Right.
And he met her at a well.
Right.
And he watered her flocks. And again, they didn't know each other, right? So we see again, perhaps we'll just look at that story if I can find it. Where does Jacob meet his wife? So what it says here is... Yes, I mean, just don't look for it. It'll take too long. Verse 29, chapter 29 of Genesis, verse 8. He rolled the stone off the mouth of the well and watered her sheep. So anyway, the point is that our forefathers were in many cases fugitives. They were exiles. They had to leave behind their identity. And secondly, we see this matter of hospitality and of helping the other.
Didn't we have that here? With people coming in from all over the world to the United States, from Russia, from Poland, from wherever, and leaving things behind forever.
Yeah. Yep.
And then you have the joint helping them.
Helping them. Right.
Or you have the Dallas community.
Right. That's the model for thousands of years. So, a little bit now of the commentators in our source book. I wrote on the sheet that I gave out that of the 11 commentators in the book, I hope to see 5 of them, 5, 6, 7, 9, 11, those are the ones I chose, and we'll probably see just one of them. And the question is, which should we look at? Well, I'm going to choose 11 of 5, 6, 7, 9, and 11. Let's go for 11. And 11 is on page, I don't know, we'll find
40.
Out. Say it again, please.
40.
40. Okay. Page 40. I have never met or heard of this writer. I can't even pronounce his name. Anyone?
Clendenin.
Avis.
Clendenin.
Teaches at a good Jewish university, St. Exavet, right?
Xavier.
Where is it, by the way? Anyone know?
We have Xavier University in Lyons.
Perhaps he's from the old country. In the next 10 verses, and apparently that means in verse 15 and henceforth was when he flees from Egypt and goes to Midian, the classic text reveals again its inexhaustible wisdom. The man Moshe, now 40, by the way, that's a midrash, it could also be that he's just 20 when he flees, perhaps even 18. The man Moses, now 40, symbolically speaking, wanders uncertain and unhealed. While there are no biblical details of his interior experience, it is not a significant leap of imagination to suggest that during this season of wilderness wandering, Moshe's sense of alienation, anger, self-accusation and loneliness must have been acute and unremitting. No doubt the challenges of this new time, so different from his previously privileged life, change his priorities. His daily search for basic human needs opens him to the issues of survival faced by those he meets along the desert way. The daily emotional, physical strains of fleeing from fear and searching for safety and security sharpen his instincts and open his senses to reading his inner and outer environments. Far from being a purely negative experience of blaming others for his plight, Moshe's forced encounter with the desert is a blessing in disguise. When Moshe wanders into the land of Midian, he had become a different man than the one who fled Egypt in anger and in fear. It is not by chance that Moshe finds his way to a well where women come to draw water. The women in the water are suggestive of an impending season of new birth for Moshe. Aggressive shepherds, a symbolic oxymoron because shepherds are supposed to be shepherding, threaten the women by preventing them from drawing water from the well. Without hesitation or self-regard, Moshe intervenes on their behalf. This time, however, no one is killed. Moshe dispels the threat to the women and proceeds to assist them in their task. Text records that Moshe stood up and helped them and watered their flock. Moshe's capacity for avenging anger is once again displayed. I don't understand that sentence. His capacity for avenging anger is once again displayed. I don't understand. Irrespective of his own personal turmoil, he remains attentive to injustice and brutality leveled undeservingly at others. Moses acts this time, however, in a new way. Moses stands up to the intruders at the well and helps the women. While the aggressive shepherds are more in number, Moses' manliness dissuades them from hurting the women, and Moses' gentleness enables him to take the time to help them with their task. It is not beneath him or an insult to his strength to help women draw water from a well and then water their flock with them. Where once anger went unmediated and resulted in destruction, now anger is mediated by empathy and results in a constructive outcome for all. During the wilderness desert wandering period of Moses' life, he encountered his own vulnerability. Suffering from an unrestrained and violent, volatile personality, Moses discovers through his grief and loneliness that he has the capacity for more gentle relationality. Moses settles into a healing relational time. The period of time that Moses spends in Midian is one of preparation, inner unfolding, and growth. Guided by the wisdom figure Yitro, a wife and a child, and the ways of shepherding, Moses now sojourns into the inner territory of reciprocal love. The experience of authentic mutual loving is always healing. They say men never mature until they get married and have children. The psychological and spiritual development of Moshe in Midian centers largely on his relationship with... I didn't hear what you said, but I suspect.
I have three children. Two of them are married, one is still at home.
I love it.
So now, where is the savior that's going to stand up and save the downtrodden?
I'm very happy to
do that. There are good benefits by not rebelling.
Anyway, I just read the experience of authentic mutual loving is always healing.
Well, we're working on it. Another 50 years.
The psychological and spiritual development of Moshe in Midian centers largely on his relationship with Yitro. Jethro is the wise, caring father figure who redeems the absent father of his origins and the harsh taskmaster father Paro. Literally speaking, the name Yitro means overflowing with excellent qualities. That's a midrash. Yitro does mean overflowing, but with excellent qualities, that's a midrash. As Moses heals, he readies unaware to hear the voice waiting to encounter the depths of his soul. Scripture suggests Moses spends 40 years in Midian. By the way, it might be 60. The symbolic length of his time is to teach us that the process of psycho-spiritual integration is not accomplished overnight. The Midian experience is a season of inner attunement for Moshe. It is a lengthy time of growth necessary for Moshe to be able to hear the voice that would be unmistakably true, perfectly clear, and compelling. The impending encounter with self directs Moshe to take up his destiny and continue his life work on a new scale. That's nice, I think.
He is a professor at the Catholic University in Chicago.
So that is Xavier in Chicago?
Yeah.
Just like Loyola.
Yeah. I guess there's in more than one place.
Yeah.
So there's a number of things we could indicate or talk about. I'll just tell you the things that struck me in this piece. Is the first that he points out that when Moshe encounters the daughters of the shepherd at the well, he is at a low point in his life, and we could have justified him not getting involved because he's despondent, he's lonely, he's scared. And despite the fact that he has all these things on his plate, he nevertheless gets involved and stands up for these shepherdesses. So he's really a man of deep, 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 deep empathy. Another point is the very clear criticism that this text has of Moshe in his younger days, that he acted angrily and impetuously and avengingly against the Egyptian taskmaster.
But that's the only indication we have of that is that one. What did he kill?
Right, right.
I mean, right. He killed him, but he dwells on that anger. We don't know that he was.
We don't know.
That he
was. Yeah, and again, I would interpret it differently. I would think that the text of the Torah brought that incident to Moshe's credit, not to his discredit. Mm-hmm. But I can certainly see another way of looking at it. Anyone else want to comment on what we see here?
Well, all of this certainly does make it seem like, you know, we always say, well, why did God choose Moses? Why did he get picked to be the one? But going through all of these various stages here in this, in the way he also says that all those years in Midian also helped him to be able to hear the inner voice, as he says, sort of helps us understand perhaps why God chose Moses to be the one.
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly think that is the reason why all these stories are brought about him.
I also don't know whether anybody else was around who could have even done it. I mean, he may have been it.
At the well, you mean?
You know, he may have been it throughout. As a leader. He was the one, the only one, maybe, who did all this. I mean, there was no competition, you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to diminish Moshe, but what I'm saying is, there was no other person.
That could be. But, you know, I would say, even if that's the case, what do we take from this? Clearly, the Torah is setting up an example, a paragon of leadership, and telling us that leadership has to be based on a deep, deep sense of justice and empathy and willingness to act. Right? It's not just about having a degree in business administration. It's not just about the technicalities. There has to be there that empathy and sense of deep morality and an indignation when you see something wrong. It has to hurt you. It has to really roil your kishkes inside. You can't be
a bystander.
Yeah. Okay, so you're always welcome to look at the other sources in the source book during the course of the week. Next week there's no class, the week after there's no class, and then we said we're coming back on the 18th of April.
Yes, you're going to
Israel. Okay. I didn't know what was going on.
You're going to Israel, right?
And I'm going to Israel another few days.
Oh.